Hi, I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's to the best of our knowledge. And in 1974, Patty Hearst, the heir to the Hearst family fortune, was kidnapped by the Symbionese Liberation Army. Then, a few months later, they released a recording of Patty saying she had joined their cause. And who could forget the famous photo of Patty Hearst wielding a machine gun while robbing a bank, her face weirdly expressionless.
It is almost a perfect metaphor for the mystery of her captivity as a whole, because you just can't know for sure what she's thinking or feeling in that photograph.
Was Patty Hearst, as she later claimed, brainwashed? Journalist Jeffrey Toobin tries to uncover the truth, because that is what journalists do. But is it ever possible to really know the whole truth about anyone? We all have secrets. Today, we're going to talk with three journalists, each of whom took on an assignment to tell the truth, the whole truth, about someone who was in some crucial way unknowable.
I was sitting around actually boxing up my files on a book I had just written about masculinity when I received this email from my father that said, basically, "Dear Susan, I have interesting news for you. I've decided that I am not the aggressive macho man that I've been impersonating all these years." The rest of the explanation was in the pictures. My father sent me this series of snapshots. In one of them, my father's wearing a kind of sleeveless chemise and a red skirt, and the caption says, "I look tired after the surgery," and a number of pictures of my father in dresses. And this was the announcement that my father had become a woman.
This is Susan Faludi, the Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. She's the author of Backlash, The Undeclared War Against American Women, a book that's been called a feminist classic. She also wrote another one called Stiffed, about American manhood. And now she's back with her most personal story, about her struggle to deal with her father's unexpected revelation.
First of all, my father was 76 years old. And second of all, my father and I had pretty much been estranged for a quarter century. So it was a lot to digest.
What was your reaction?
At first, utter befuddlement. It took me quite a while to absorb it. I remember that night, my husband and I went to a concert. It was a Schnittke concert. Schnittke's Requiem for a Dead Mother. And I was sitting there listening to the music and just overcome, realizing, you know, I thought I had my father pegged all these years and I really knew nothing.
There must have been a kind of eeriness quotient to it also. I mean, you're a journalist who's written extensively about gender. As you said, you just finished a book on masculinity. It seems crazy to suddenly have all these questions about gender reappear in your own life in this very intimate, personal way.
Yes. I mean, my father had pretty much driven a Trojan horse into my professional and political domain. And in my confusion and bewilderment, I decided, since I'm a journalist, that I would go find out about this. And at the same time, in the phone call that followed the email, my father invited me to write her story. So that's how this whole investigation over 12 years began.
Had there been any hints that you had seen growing up with your father that he might have, I don't know, an unusual or novel approach to gender?
I was aware that my father was always trying on roles, sort of adopting a series of masks. And looking back, most of those roles involved a sort of performance, not to sound like an academic theorist, but a performance of hyper-masculinity, whether my father was playing the part of the controlling patriarch at home, the kind of household despot, domineering and even violent, or my father was kind of the ultimate sportsman. My father and I together, at my father's insistence, when we were rock climbing, rappelling down cliffs, doing a marathon bicycle ride through the Swiss Alps. So there were all these sort of dramas unfolding that were around manhood. But I think my father's confusion about, you know, what does my identity mean went beyond that.
Right. Well, he has this really interesting background. I mean, he was a young Jewish boy during the Holocaust, which talk about raising identity problems or questions. And he literally had to transform his identity during that time, didn't he?
Yes. I mean, my father, as a small child, was the only child of my grandparents who were wealthy, bourgeois, Budapest Jews. They had led this sort of privileged life. They had their summer villa. My grandfather owned two large luxury apartment buildings in Budapest. Everything was hunky-dory. And then comes the war, and my father basically becomes an urchin on the streets trying to pass as Christian and managing to pass as Christian with nothing other than a false identity papers and a stolen fascist armband, which my father ultimately used to impersonate a fascist Hungarian Arrow Cross officer to rescue his parents.
And that's an extraordinary story, which you had to really pry out of him later on. But what did you eventually discover had happened?
When I was growing up, I had little shards, but my father was not big on talking about the past. So, you know, I knew that my father had pulled my grandparents out of what was a Swiss protected house that was no longer protected. And my father, who had some contacts with the so-called resistance in Hungary, there wasn't a great resistance, but he had found out that the Arrow Cross, which was Hungarian version of Nazis, were about to raid this protected house and deport the occupants or, as often happened, shoot them into the Danube. So my father, with this armband and a rifle that had no bullets, and my father wouldn't have known how to shoot it anyway, marched up to this protected house and said that he had orders to take those Jews, the Freedmans, which was my grandparents' name back then, out of there. And he marched in and ordered at gunpoint, marched them down the stairs. I knew a teeny bit about it when I was growing up, and when I would push, my father would never tell me more. So when I started researching this, I wound up going to Israel to see my relatives, who my father also didn't speak to, so I hadn't met them before. And it turned out that not only had my father rescued my grandparents, but my father had also rescued his uncle. So if anything, my father was kind of downplaying his valor.
So he had this heroic past. And yet, you know, from a very early age, survival depended on identity and having to mask his identity. Was there a gender component at all to that early on during that time, do you think?
Well, there's a gender component in one way, in that it's far more difficult to pass as a Christian during the Holocaust if you're male, because there was an easy way to figure out, just look to see whether you've been circumcised or not. And this actually had a term at the time. It was known as trouser inspections, and was,
wow,
you know, obviously an immense fear for any Jewish man on the street. That said, I don't think, you know, it's not like the Holocaust was a switch that flipped my father's gender.
Right. What impact do you think he had on you growing up? Because you said the two of you, at the time you got this startling email out of the blue, the two of you had been estranged for nearly a quarter century. And he had been, as you said, a household despot, a macho, very controlling, in fact, even sometimes violent man, right?
Yeah, I mean, the violence was contained to the latter days of my parents' marriage. My father, who didn't want the divorce, became increasingly aggressive in his insistence that nothing change. And when threats and browbeating didn't work, my father became physically violent, culminating in a pretty awful bloody night where my father broke in with a baseball bat and a knife.
Was anyone hurt?
Yes, a man who my mother had just begun dating was in the line of fire, so to speak, and got pretty beat up. And that moment, not surprisingly, catalyzed my feminism.
So what do you think it meant when you get this email and your father announces that she's done with impersonating a macho, aggressive man and that she's become a woman? I mean, it's obviously a huge physical change, but did you get the feeling that she was also saying, who I was as your father is not who I really am inside?
That's what she was suggesting. You know, I think this is all extremely complicated. And then, I mean, my initial reaction was everything from, you know, sympathy for her to suspicion to wondering, okay, does this mean she is this just does she just think this is going to be a get out of jail card? You know, I'm absolved of all my sins because that wasn't really me.
So she was living in Budapest in Hungary at the time, and you went to visit. So tell me about the first time you laid eyes on her. What was that like?
Yeah, I got on a plane and went over, and there was my father waiting for me. You know, people ask me, oh, what was that like the first time to see your father in a dress? What was your father wearing? And wasn't that a shock? And I have to say, you know, I mean, it somewhat took me aback. It was something to get used to, but it didn't take that much getting used to. I have to say what the hardest part about it was all the ways that my father had not changed, all the baggage we had between us, all the ghosts that haunted our shared past.
So it was like I'm seeing this person in, what, I don't know, high heels and pearls, but oh my God, it's really still my father.
Yeah, of course my father was still my father.
Right.
These are external things. I think there was a deeper aspect of the gender change that was really important for my father and really important for our relationship. And that was that my father had decided, as she put it to me, I don't want to be this closed-in man anymore. I want to be able to communicate with people. I want to have some kind of emotional connection. And my father used her gender change to evolve in that way. I mean, it wasn't dramatic. It wasn't night or day, but she came to be more open. And I think, and also the other part of it is that we worked for the first time really spending real time together, you know, and I was part of the process of drawing her out by being the dogged journalist, which she enjoyed. We'd play this kind of cat and mouse game where I'd ask her questions and she would sort of withhold some of them, but then she would come back around sometimes 10 minutes later, sometimes 2 weeks later, and give me a little more material to work with it. And she, you know, she really enjoyed talking about her whole story, a story that she had hidden for so long.
Well, it seems like she really wanted to show herself to you and to bond as women together. But there are times when that sounds like it must have been uncomfortable. She wanted to show you her body. She wanted to talk about the surgery in pretty explicit detail.
Right. And I shuffled back and forth from being the daughter and being the journalist. I mean, the daughter part of me was, you know, forget it. I don't want to see your surgery. My father had had the surgery filmed. Not the entire surgery, but as she put it, the highlights, but 5 minutes of the highlights of watching any surgery, right? I mean, it doesn't even matter what it is. It's just gory and not what I wanted to see. But then the journalist in me was interested.
Why do you think your father wanted to become a woman?
You know, I think there were so many reasons. First of all, I think there was something very deep and that went back to childhood. I mean, my father talked about that from the time my father was, you know, 7, 8, maybe even earlier, she remembers putting on her, you know, secretly putting on her mother's clothes. They had a maid putting on the maid's clothes, sort of Hungarian peasant dress. So I mean, I think there was a part of it that was always there. And maybe that part is, who knows, that's one of the great life mysteries. Why are we the way we are? But I think on top, layered on top of that, were other more, you know, desires that developed later of wanting to be more emotional, wanting to open up, perhaps, you know, wanting to be a different person, feeling guilt and shame over some of her actions as a man. It's a very complicated mix, and I don't pretend to have gotten all the way to the bottom of it. I don't know that my father ever really knew. It just was a compelling and undeniable need.
Your father's struggle, I mean, to a certain extent, struggling with identity and trying to define yourself is always something we do partly in the eyes of other people, right? Because if there weren't people perceiving us, we wouldn't have any of these questions about our identity. You know, your father wanted a mirror, and you, in turn, wanted to expose all the secrets as a journalist, investigate your father's past, and sometimes against her wishes. But it seems like, at heart, the story of a father and daughter locked in this kind of epic struggle, but I'm not sure what the struggle was for.
Oh, I think the struggle was for understanding, for understanding each other, and for my father, a deep, deep desire to be perceived. And I think in many ways she chose me because she knew I was the sort of unrelenting investigative reporter. I mean, she would brag to people about, oh, well, my daughter, she never pulls her punches. You know, and she's doing a very thorough job in this, in finding out everything about me. So, I mean, I think after a lifetime of being in a psychic dark room, my father wanted finally to come out into the light and wanted me to be the one who perceived and shared that perception. And for me, I mean, I am just immensely grateful that I was able to have those 12 years getting back into connection with my father. I regret that there weren't more.
Susan Faludi is a Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist. Her new book about her father is called In the Dark Room. And the underlying theme we're exploring this hour is how journalists get at the whole truth when their access to the person they're writing about is compromised in some way. Coming up, Jeffrey Toobin revisits one of the most celebrated and least understood crimes of the 1970s, the kidnapping of Patty Hearst. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. From Wisconsin Public Radio, NPRI, Public Radio International. It's one thing to write a complicated piece of journalism when you have a willing subject and full access. Obviously, it's a whole lot tougher when you don't. Jeffrey Toobin is a staff writer at The New Yorker and the senior legal analyst at CNN. He's had a lot of experience writing stories about people who do not want to be written about. Most recently, Patty Hearst. So, quick refresher. In 1974, Patty Hearst, the heir to the Hearst family fortune, was kidnapped from her college apartment by the Symbionese Liberation Army. This was a group of would-be leftist revolutionaries. 2 months later, they released a recording of Patty saying she was joining their cause. This shocked the world. And then came the famous photo of Patty Hearst helping rob a bank while brandishing a machine gun. And later in the trial, after they were all captured, Patty said she'd been brainwashed by the group's leader, Donald DeFries. But was she? Doug Gordon sat down to talk with Jeff Toobin about his investigation of the story in his new book, American Heiress.
The heart of this story is whether Patricia Hearst was brainwashed or whether she went along voluntarily with the Symbionese Liberation Army. And throughout your book, you write about what you believe was going through Hearst's mind during this entire ordeal. Were you able to interview her?
I wasn't. I tried very hard. I wrote, I called. I had one conversation with her, which I can recount in its entirety, after many electronic and letter writing approaches failed, I just called her. I had her number, and she answered the phone, and I said, "Hi, Patricia, this is Jeff Toobin." And she said, "Oh, God, click." So I sort of got the picture that she wasn't interested in cooperating. That was too bad, but as I write in an author's note in the book, I had many vehicles, many opportunities to get her thinking on this case, whether through her book, her testimony, her various interviews with the FBI and others. So, of course, I would have preferred to interview her, but I did feel like I knew in substantial detail what she thought about these underlying events.
This is a big challenge that you undertook with this book. On the one hand, you're a journalist, and yet at the same time, it seems to me like you're trying to do a novelist job by inhabiting a character who happens to be a real person, Patricia Hearst.
And a woman.
Yeah, and a woman. So how were you able to balance these different approaches and conflicting approaches while you were writing the book?
Well, you know, I thought a lot about that question. The guiding principle that I operated by, to the extent I can articulate it, is, you know, there are a lot of buzzwords associated with this case, most famously brainwashing and Stockholm syndrome. Mm-hmm. And I wanted to avoid use of those terms in part because they are journalistic, not medical, and don't have specific psychiatric meanings. But more importantly, I thought it would be better to focus on what actually happened. What did Patricia do? What did all the other people do and say? Because that, I felt like I was in a good position to recount. You know, I felt less confident in my ability to articulate what people were thinking and why they were thinking that. I mean, I didn't foreclose that altogether. Obviously, I do discuss that to a certain extent, but I wanted to focus on sort of the journalistic basics of the story rather than the speculative part of it.
Mm-hmm. Were there times at all where you found yourself struggling with ethical dilemmas in terms of what you were doing?
I did. I mean, there was one moment in particular, one issue in particular that I was particularly sensitive about and thought about a lot how to portray it, and that's Patricia's claim that she was sexually assaulted while in the first period after she was kidnapped in February of 1974. Because in her book, she claims that Donald DeFries, the leader of the group, and Willie Wolfe, who the SLA asserts was her lover, forced themselves on her sexually. The SLA survivors basically agree with most everything Patricia says about the nature of the kidnapping and her captivity, except they assert in the most vociferous way that she was never sexually assaulted and any sexual conduct she had, particularly with Willie Wolfe, was consensual. And that dilemma, that contradiction, was an area where I felt I needed to tread especially carefully.
So how did you go about doing that? How did you tread carefully?
Mostly, I just was candid with the reader and said, you know, on most issues, there's really not dispute about what happened. But here, there is one. Federal prosecutors later claimed that Patricia fabricated this story. Having covered many sexual assault cases for television and in print, I am aware of the sensitivity of the issue. Also, the frequent claim that women make this up, which is usually false. Also, you know, in the 1970s, the idea of what consent means in a sexual context was very different than it is today. In those days, a man couldn't be convicted of rape unless the woman had forcibly resisted. And the whole idea of whether a woman who has been kidnapped and being held in a closet can be said meaningfully to consent to sex, I think we look at that in a very different prism than we did in 1974.
It seems like what this book has in common with your other books, your book about O.J. Simpson, The Run of His Life, and your other books, is that you carved out this certain kind of investigative project for yourself. In your books, it seems to me that you're writing about subjects that we think we know, but then you give us a different perspective. Is that the way you see your work?
One of my mentors in journalism, Michael Kinsley, said, there are only two stories worth writing. One is, it's worse than you think, and the other is, everything you thought you knew is wrong. I don't go quite that far. But one of the things I have learned, especially, you know, it came to light very much this year in this sort of O.J. Simpson revival, the wonderful FX series based on my book and the terrific ESPN documentary, is that even when people think they know the whole story, they don't. I mean, I know the O.J. Simpson story as well as anybody, and I was riveted and fascinated and highly informed by Ezra Edelman's documentary. I didn't know a lot of that stuff. And I think when we are interested in a story, we have the curiosity to find out more about it. And so I never really buy the argument that, oh, you know, people are sick of it and they know everything. If people are interested enough to be sick of it, they're interested enough to see another good version of it.
I renounce my class privilege, and I would never choose to live the rest of my life surrounded by pigs like the Hearsts. Patria o muerte, venceremos. Death to the fascist insect that preys upon the life of the people.
So after Patricia Hearst was kidnapped, the SLA took a photo of her that became one of the most famous images of the 1970s. Can you describe it for me?
It's a photograph of Patricia holding a machine gun against a backdrop of the red SLA flag, which had a seven-headed cobra on it. In the book, I describe this photograph, you know, not facetiously, as the Mona Lisa of the 1970s because, as in the famous painting, Patricia's expression is inscrutable. You can study this picture for a long time, as I certainly have, and you can see her as terrified, you can see her as proud, you can see her as happy, you can see her as sad, you can see her as ready to fight. It is almost a perfect metaphor for the mystery of her captivity as a whole because you just can't know for sure what she's thinking or feeling in that photograph.
What do you see her as in that photo?
Well, I see her as a revolutionary fighter. I see her as a comrade. When you see what was going on, it was right around the time of the first bank robbery. You see that she was increasingly left alone by the other SLA members because they weren't worried about her running away. She was a participant in the bank robbery, as the jury in her case found. She was in love with Willie Wolfe, who was one of the kidnappers. And this moment in late April of 1974, before the group moved to Los Angeles, was their most successful time because, as they hoped and predicted, the photographs of Patricia in the bank wielding a machine gun caused a national sensation.
Yeah. One of the key incidents in this whole story happened at a sporting goods store in Inglewood, California on May 16th, 1974. Can you tell me about that?
Well, the bank robbery was April 15th, and the heat got intense from the police in San Francisco, so they fled. There were nine of them at that point, to Los Angeles, Donald DeFries' hometown. And they rented a little house, and they started to go a little stir-crazy. So on May 16th, three of the nine decided to go shopping, Bill and Emily Harris and Patricia. And they went to a grocery store and they went to a newsstand. And then they went to Mel's Sporting Goods to get some clothes. And Bill and Emily went inside, leaving Patricia across four lanes of traffic in a parked van with the key in the ignition and her with complete freedom. She could have driven away. She could have walked away. She could have called the police. She could have called home. But she stayed in the van while Bill and Emily went inside. Now, because Bill is a genius, Bill decided to shoplift in the store. And the clerk, as it happened, was an aspiring police officer, Anthony Shepard. And Anthony Shepard knew that the crime of shoplifting does not take place until the individual actually leaves the premises of the store. So he sort of shadowed Bill in the store. But when Bill went outside, Anthony tackled him. And then Emily Harris jumped in. And then there was this melee in front of Mel's Sporting Goods with Patricia across the street. So what does Patricia do? Does she run away? Does she drive away? Does she do nothing? No. Patricia goes into the back of the van, picks up a machine gun, pokes it out the window, and shoots up the whole facade of Mel's Sporting Goods in an effort to free her colleagues, which she does. And Bill and Emily extricate themselves from Anthony Shepard and get in the van, and the three of them drive off. Now, it's my view that this act of shooting up Mel's Sporting Goods is as vivid and clear a demonstration of Patricia's loyalties at this point as anything she said much, much later. And that's why I think it's such an important event in the history of the case.
Yeah. What is Patricia Hearst like now?
You know, one of the amazing aspects of this whole story is that she has led the life for which she was destined. She is a wealthy lady in the suburbs. She, you know, is a mother. She's a grandmother. Unfortunately, she's a widow. She is conservative, like most of the Hearsts are conservative. And, you know, the whole thing, and I'm not trying to be flip, but it's like the whole thing was like the junior year abroad from hell. But she has led the life for which she was destined, which, again, may seem surprising, but it's also, you know, predictable in a way. Despite our best efforts and hopes, you know, we all sort of turn into our parents, and that's what happened to her, too.
Jeffrey Toobin is the author of American Heiress, the wild saga of the kidnapping, crimes, and trial of Patty Hearst. He also wrote the book that inspired the hit TV series about O.J. Simpson's trial, The Run of His Life. He talked with Doug Gordon. And now, found films, movies you might have missed.
Hi, I'm Rodney Asher, director of The Nightmare and Room 237. I'm going to recommend Paul Schrader's 1988 film, Patty Hearst.
Of course, there is little one can do to prepare for the unknown.
You know, in the 80s, Paul Schrader was just on fire, and he made some of my favorite films, from American Gigolo to Cat People to Mishima and Patty Hearst, which is like a fantastic reconstruction, you know, of her days in the SLA. Natasha Richardson plays Patty Hearst, and she's, you know, she's just great. And it also uses, you know, something that I just love in film, which is a endless black void. In fact, I tried to use a couple of them in The Nightmare. And it does it in a few moments in ways that just prompt all sorts of questions. There's, you know, a long scene where she's like trapped in the closet, after she was kidnapped, and sort of the back end of the closet just disappears into an endless chasm, almost evocative of House of Leaves. And there's a scene towards the end where, like, the lawyers are getting together and debating, you know, how they're going to prosecute her. But it reveals the office from, like, a sort of a crane shot that starts in complete blackness and reveals the set floating almost in outer space. And I'm not sure if it's trying to get at something about memory or, you know, acknowledging the artificiality of the scene itself. But, you know, by the time the camera gets into the room, we completely buy that we're in a real place now, even though we got there, you know, through this endless black abyss. And, you know, for me, that almost reminds me of the way Penn and Teller do their magic, you know, that they'll often kind of reveal what they're going to do and how they're going to do it. But when they do the trick, it still works and you still believe it. One thing I really like about it, you know, is its blending of fact and fiction. Clearly it is, you know, a based on life narrative account, but it feels so authentic in its details. I don't know that it's much more of a hybrid documentary narrative film than other films based on true stories, but I don't know, it sure feels that way to me. You know, it's just an amazing movie.
Film director Rodney Asher with his movie recommendation, Paul Schrader's Patty Hearst. You'll find more audio extras on our website at ttbook.org. We're talking about how journalists find the truth against all odds. Coming up, historian Jill Lepore on her search for an elusive lost manuscript called The Oral History of Our Time. I'm Anne Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International. Joe Gould was one of those legendary New York characters. He claimed to have invented oral history and to be working on a groundbreaking 9-million-word history of the 20th century. Now, when Joseph Mitchell, the famous New Yorker writer, heard about this, he decided to investigate. He wound up writing a long story about Gould. It was one of the most popular profiles ever published in The New Yorker, and this was all back in 1942. Joe Gould died in 1957, but there was no sign of that 9-million-word manuscript. So Joseph Mitchell wrote a second story, a quarter century after the first one, in which he claimed there never had been a manuscript. Joe Gould just made the whole thing up. And this has been a mystery, a literary mystery about Joe Gould and about Joseph Mitchell ever since. And now along comes another New Yorker writer, Jill Lepore, and she thinks maybe that manuscript did actually exist. And she set out to find it. The result is her book, Joe Gould's Teeth. Steve Paulson sat down with her to find out more.
Yeah, so I reread the essays for a class I was teaching at Harvard, and when I was rereading it, I had forgotten that a ton of the story involves Harvard. Gould claimed to have graduated from Harvard in 1911, and he said that at his death, the entire manuscript would be given, well, two-thirds would be given to the Harvard Library and the other to the Smithsonian, and that he carried around a will deeding it and making that arrangement. And so I was kind of getting ready for class, and I thought, oh, shoot. Maybe someone should just check. I should just go to the library and see. Like, maybe it's there. It'd be hard to lose 9 million words in, you know, hundreds of dime store composition notebooks, but bigger things have been lost in the Harvard Library. So I went over to the archives, just a couple steps from my office, and I went to the undergraduate records files, and I pulled Joe Gould's undergraduate record file, Joe Gould, class of 1911. And normally these things are like a sheet. It's like a transcript, or, you know, maybe there's one other page, like a letter to a dean or something. It's a stack. It's a good ream of paper, maybe more. Almost all of it, letters from Joe Gould, who has very distinctive handwriting and very clearly illustrated one fact that Mitchell got right, which is that Gould had graphomania. This is a person who could not stop writing. I mean, this is this outpouring of letters to his deans, to each of his professors. This is like your worst email nightmare, the person who will never leave you alone. It's all crazy. And just looking through the first few pages, he didn't graduate in 1911, as he told Mitchell and as Mitchell reported to readers. He was kicked out. He had a nervous breakdown. He was unable to do his work in any case, and he was not allowed back because of his mental illness, which seemed, on the basis of these papers, to be quite grave for him even as a very young man. There were just all kinds of crazy clues and hints in these letters that I, you know, sat and read in a day that led me to believe that there was much, much more to the story of the oral history of our time than Mitchell knew.
But why did you then think that maybe that oral history really did exist?
There are hints of such a project in the letters in the record file. So I thought, well, I'll take a few next steps. Because, you know, when Mitchell was writing these pieces, Gould's letters would have been at the Harvard archives, but Gould wrote to a lot of other people. You know, these databases exist of where people's papers are, so you can search by name. And I went to see, well, were any of Joe Gould's papers in the papers of anyone else? So the papers of E.E. Cummings or Ezra Pound or William Carlos Williams or Marianne Moore or The Dial Magazine or New Directions Press or Lewis Mumford or Edmund Wilson or The New Republic or The Nation, any of the places that Gould wrote for, people that he knew and worked with, people that testified about him to Mitchell. And it turns out all these people's papers are in archives now because they're long since dead and their families collected their papers and they've given them to archives. And they all have correspondence files titled Gould, Joseph. So then there's this sort of chase. And okay, well, I'll just see. So I wonder, I'll look at E.E. Cummings' papers and just see. Well, there's stacks of Gould letters in the Cummings paper. And a lot of the letters are about the oral history. Huh. And it doesn't seem fictional to either of the correspondents.
Or it's the greatest con ever done that, you know, somehow Joe Gould managed to tell, you know, the who's who of the literati that he had written this. And they all ended up writing about it in their own papers.
But you can imagine, as a historian, oh, your ears kind of prick up. Because the harder it is to disprove that it existed, the more likely it is that it did once exist. And if it existed, even if only some portion of it still survives, wouldn't that be really important? What if this guy really did write down what people said on an ordinary day in 1924? There's a whole dimensionality to the past that it offers that we just don't have for that period. And in particular, Gould was obsessed with the Harlem Renaissance and spent most of his time not in Greenwich Village, but in Harlem. So what if he had written down what Langston Hughes said to me in a coffee shop one day? What Zora Neale Hurston said when I went with her down to the library?
Yeah.
Like, wouldn't you want to have that? Oh, well, the chance seems slim, but I better keep looking. So then I really got this book, and it was dreadful.
Okay, so you did find some excerpts from this oral history.
What became obvious reading the correspondence of these other writers who knew Gould far better than Mitchell ever did, they'd known him for decades, was that Gould had been insane from childhood. He had suffered from a severe mental illness from childhood, but he had been first locked up in the 1920s. One of the reasons that he was brought to insane asylums repeatedly was because he was known to attack women and was considered dangerous. And Mitchell had some glimpses of this. One woman wrote to him at the time and said, you know, Gould was actually a monster. You've got him completely wrong. He's not some charming eccentric. He was a monster. But the monstrosity of Joseph Gould comes across pretty loud and clear early on in the correspondence. That doesn't mean the oral history exists.
Yeah.
It doesn't exist. It's not dispositive one way or the other. But it means that if something has been hidden, what's been hidden, what I know to have been hidden or not seen by Mitchell, maybe that he didn't understand, was that Gould was not a harmless person.
Well, and then there was another piece to that as well. I mean, he seemed to be a racist, right?
Yeah, which doesn't distinguish him from pretty much anybody in his society at the time. But he was obsessed with race, which does distinguish him from a lot of other people. He had one particular fixation, which was he was obsessed with the idea of sex between a white man and a black woman. He was a eugenicist in his young life, and he had worked for the Eugenics Records Office collecting pedigrees and documenting the skin color of Native Americans in the Midwest. And he was fascinated by the degenerative effect of the darker races on the lighter ones, but also on the ameliorating effect. I mean, Gould had a really complicated set of ideas about race. In any case, he was obsessed with racial mixture, and it seems that his attentions to women were directed almost invariably at black women.
I presume he thought the whole idea of mixing races was a horrible idea. I mean, if he was a eugenicist, and yet he himself was personally fixated on black women.
Yeah, so he did and he didn't. He was an unstable person, so his ideas are not fixed, nor are anyone's ideas about this question particularly fixed in the 19-teens and 20s and 30s. He, as a young person, as a eugenicist, was very vehemently opposed to racial mixing because he thought it would interfere with racial equality, that in order for the races to become politically equal, they needed to be racially distinct. This is a sort of weird kind of inverted Garveyism. He, in fact, reversed that idea, and it became insistent that the races should mix, and that in particular, this one black woman should have sex with him, and that if she didn't, it was because she didn't believe in racial equality.
He pursued this one black artist, well known in the Harlem Renaissance, Augusta Savage, and apparently he basically stalked her for years.
Yeah, and this was really hard to reconstruct archivally because Savage seems to have destroyed most of her own papers, indeed much of her own art. And I think most of that has to do with her difficulties with Joe Gould. Savage was the best-known artist of the Harlem Renaissance. She was a sculptor. She was a sort of social center for artists. She also taught a lot of Harlem Renaissance artists, so her real legacy is actually in her students, people like Jacob Lawrence. In any case, Gould met her in 1923 when she was giving a poetry reading with Langston Hughes and Gwendolyn Bennett. He, you know, later said he fell in love with her at first sight. And from that day forward, really never left her alone. She seems to have tried to go to the police, didn't get any assistance from them. Gould, when he was brought before the police for harassing other women, was repeatedly let off. Well-known writers like Edmund Wilson and E. Cummings would go to the police and testify on his behalf as character witnesses and get the charges dropped. But much of the hype about the oral history of our time, it turns out, was the efforts of Gould's white modernist writer friends to protect him from being arrested and being sent back to a mental institution or being sent to jail. And there's really only one person who leaves behind an evidentiary trail that makes it possible to see what was really going on. And it's this writer named Millen Brand, who's a white man, but goes on to become really active in the civil rights movement. And he knows Gould through his wife. And Gould asks him to intervene with Augusta Savage and help bring them together. So Brand goes to talk to Augusta Savage. This is in 1934. And says, you know, I'm good friends with Joe Gould. You know, he's this great writer. He really loves you. And I guess you guys had some kind of misunderstanding or something. And I just hope you'll give him another chance. I mean, he's really heartbroken. And Savage, this person has been making my life daily miserable, unutterably miserable. He never leaves me alone. He calls me. He comes to my shows. He writes me endless letters. He wants to marry me. There's a lot of intimation that there's been sexual violence. But Brand writes this all out in letters to Joseph Mitchell in 1964 after Joe Gould's Secret comes out. And he says, Brand is himself a very successful writer and has spent most of his career as an excellent literary editor. And he says, you know, I really loved your piece, Joe Gould's Secret, and it was a beautiful piece of writing. But I just going to say, you're totally wrong that the oral history didn't exist. I read it. And the longest parts of it were about Augusta Savage. And it was actually quite a fascinating and skillful and quite important piece of writing. You know, I wouldn't put it past Joe Gould to have destroyed it all.
Yeah, wow. What eventually happened to Joe Gould?
Right after Professor Siegel came out in The New Yorker in 1942, days after that, really, he had another breakdown and was committed to the Manhattan State Hospital for the Insane. Mitchell goes to see him when he finds out months later, because he'd actually is so delusional that no one's able to find out his name or figure out who he is. But Mitchell finds him and goes to see him, and the psychiatrist tells him that Gould's a psychopath. He manages to be released from the hospital after some time with some social services. He's supported for a number of years, 3 years, by a very interesting psychiatrist who's curious to see if, relieved of the daily struggle of finding enough to eat and a place to sleep, Gould could actually produce this great work that people believed was in his head if it hadn't been written down. He's clearly a spectacular person in a thousand ways. So he's supported, and he still doesn't produce that work. And he ends up back in the hospital and in and out of the hospital for a number of years until he's finally brought to Pilgrim State Hospital, which is the place where lobotomy is perfected. And I wasn't able to get his medical records from the hospital, but I found a lot of circumstantial evidence to very strongly suggest that in 1947, Gould was lobotomized. And so he dies 10 years later in that same hospital. Mitchell gets a phone call about it. One of Gould's other friends, Slater Brown, who'd been probably his closest and longest friend, gets a telegram from the hospital, and he asks, were there any papers? Did he have anything in his possession? And the director of the hospital says, not a scrap.
Wow. So what do you do with, I mean, not just what do you do with a story like this? I mean, you've written a book about it, but what do you make of someone like Joe Gould, who was fascinating in some ways, but rather repellent in a lot of ways? And, I mean, the story that you discovered about him is mostly kind of awful.
It is mostly awful. And at a lot of points, I thought about just dropping it. I had a sort of feeling that it was a cursed story, that Joe Gould had set his curse upon Joseph Mitchell.
So Joseph Mitchell's last great piece for The New Yorker was the second profile of Joe Gould, and he basically doesn't write anything substantial for another 30 years, even though he keeps going into The New Yorker office every day. Something about that experience seemed to have blocked him in some monumental way.
Well, I thought about that when I was sitting in the New York Public Library at my desk, and they brought out the letters. There are a lot of letters from a lot of people saying, oh, my God, it's the most beautiful story I've ever read. But P.S., I knew Joe Gould, and there was an oral history. I have some of it. Would you like me to send it to you?
Meaning what Mitchell was being told was that the greatest piece he ever wrote, perhaps, was wrong. And he had to live with that.
And he had to live with that. But I think the way in which it was wrong had been for him an act of incredible kindness and generosity. Both essays were, to him, a way of shielding and protecting this broken man and making something beautiful of what was really terribly ugly. But then when I got to the Millen Brand letter and the Augusta Savage story, Gould's obsession with Augusta Savage, to have gotten that wrong, I don't know, Mitchell. And actually, a few months into the project, all I wanted to know was Augusta Savage, which is infinitely more interesting than any of these people and much more mysterious. And that's the piece that I walked away with really troubled by, because as a historian, I've always sort of thought about the historical record and its asymmetry. We know so much more about the literate and the wealthy than we know about the illiterate or the poor, as an artifact of circumstance, not as something that's deliberate. But then I thought about, well, we did have apparently at some point, because Millen Brand read it, an incredibly powerfully written account of Augusta Savage and her daily life as a working sculptor in Harlem in the 1920s and 1930s. And either Joe Gould destroyed that or Augusta Savage had him destroy that. In any case, right after Professor Siegel appeared in 1942, Augusta Savage left New York, left all of her friends, left Harlem, left her students, left her studio, left her sculptures, and moved to an unheated, tiny little house on a hill in a very small town in upstate New York where she had no electricity, and she lived there for the rest of her life in solitude, essentially in hiding, and is known only for having made the effort to send people to New York to destroy works of her own art. And so what I was left with ultimately is the very terrifying lesson that that asymmetry of the historical record isn't a function of circumstance, but can be a way that people who don't want to be known as much as historians might want to know about them erase themselves from the past.
Jill Lepore is a historian and staff writer at The New Yorker and the author of Joe Gould's Teeth. She talked with Steve Paulson. Thanks for listening today. Don't forget, we have extra podcast-only stuff available online, so look forward to The Best of Our Knowledge on iTunes or Stitcher or any other podcasting app. To The Best of Our Knowledge comes to you from Wisconsin Public Radio. Doug Gordon produced today's show, along with help from Charles Monroe Kane and Raymond Tangakar. Our theme music is by Steve Mullen from Walk West Music. Kirill Owen is our technical director. Steve Paulson is our executive producer. And I'm Anne Strainchamps. Thanks for listening.
PRI, Public Radio International.